Be discussing scattering amplitudes in the maximally supersymmetric gauge theory, and I'll go into only as much detail as is absolutely necessary. I should begin by mentioning some of the excellent collaborators I've had the pleasure of working with. First of all, of course, the mathematician Sasha Goncharov, without whom most of this work would have been impossible, my former graduate student John Golden, our former postdoc Miguel Palos, and Christian Vergu, and Anastasia Volovich. Okay. So most of my lecture today will be about material that's already known in the literature. Hopefully it's not all known to all of you, otherwise I would be wasting my time. But it's material that's generally known, and I need to develop a number of tools and ingredients which will be necessary in order to formulate the new results that we've been exploring in our recent papers. So the bodies of work that I'll have to review include a bit of background on some topics that have been extensively studied in the mathematics literature. These have to do with cluster algebras, as well as polylogarithm functions. And the main theme of my talk will be the fact that there's a very interesting, but also somewhat small, intersection between these two topics of research. And quite remarkably, the scattering amplitudes of maximally supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory appear to live in a very interesting way just in that intersection. So the theme is that some, maybe all, I'll get to that at an appropriate time, some scattering amplitudes in n equals 4 have what we call cluster structure. Now, I put this phrase in quotes, and I should emphasize right away, because I fear this point hasn't been made sufficiently clearly in some of our papers, I should be absolutely clear up front what exactly I mean by the phrase cluster structure. And the answer is I don't know. What I mean is that we're uncovering connections between scattering amplitudes and cluster algebras. Some things we know or believe are quite general features, while other things we know or believe are very specific to very certain scattering amplitudes. So for sure, the one thing I can say is that the general story in this whole business is very far from known, but what I'll be reviewing in my talks are the necessary ingredients to sort of start probing some of these questions. So the basic idea behind the research program is that people compute scattering amplitudes, usually not us. Matt is one of the people in the audience who actually does these kinds of computations. Then we analyze scattering amplitudes to try to uncover hints of this alleged cluster structure. And then when we identify interesting cluster properties of the amplitudes, we can try to promote them to principals. You know, if we observe that a certain class of scattering amplitudes has property X, we can then say, well, maybe this is some feature which has to be true because of some reason that we don't understand yet. But if we, for the moment, adopt it as a working hypothesis that that should be true, then we can use that fact or that conjecture or hypothesized fact to compute new previously uncomputed scattering amplitudes, which you then, of course, want to audit by performing as many consistency checks as you can. So this is the main theme of this research program. But I'd like to begin with a teaser. I talked about the intersection between those two branches of mathematics. Well, let's go back to the year 1881. Oh, I've already given away the punchline. Let me introduce perhaps the simplest example of something that lives right there in the intersection between those two. There's something called the A2 cluster algebra, and This is just a teaser, so I won't yet give the full definition of all of these things. I'll get to them later on in my talk. And it's generated by a set of variables satisfying. So you have a collection of variables indexed by the integers, and they satisfy what's called an exchange relation. Xi plus 1 is equal to 1 plus xi over xi minus 1. And it's evident, because this is a recursion relation that requires knowledge of the previous two variables, it's evident that you can seed this recursion by starting with two variables. Let's call them x1 and x2. And then you can proceed to calculate x3 from that recursion relation, 1 plus x2 over x1. And you can keep going. You can calculate x4. It's given by 1 plus x2 over x1 over x2, which we can simplify it a little bit. Then we come to x5. I'll spare you a little bit of algebra by just quoting the answer, x2. And finally, a little bit of a miracle happens. If we compute x6, it's 1 plus that over this. We come back to x1 again. So even though it's not at all obvious, well, certainly it's not obvious to me just by staring at this recursion relation, even though it's not obvious, it turns out that this sequence is periodic and has period 5. So x7 is x2, etc. Okay, so we'll understand later exactly what we mean when we say that these variables constitute a cluster algebra. This is just the simplest non-trivial example. But my teaser was that I wanted to show you that this has something to do with scattering amplitudes. But more specifically, I wanted to show you that it has something to do with polylogarithm functions. And this is the remarkable fact discovered by Abel, that if you take the sum, I equals 1 to 5, of the dilogarithm function, with the arguments being negative these variables, let me remind you that Li 2 of z is defined as negative the integral 0 to z log 1 minus t over t dt, then you get 0. Well, actually, you don't quite get 0. There's maybe a pi squared to the pi squared over 6 on the right-hand side, and maybe some log squared terms. Let me put that here. This means modulo pi squared and log squared terms. It is possible to correct this Li 2 function by adding to it some product of logs, such that you get an identity that this thing adds up to identically 0. But we'll see later on my talk that it's often useful when dealing with these generalized polylogarithm functions to separate things and deal with pieces of sort of different complexity at different times. Okay, so here's a very intriguing relation between polylogarithm functions and cluster algebras. And discovered already in 1881, although it certainly wasn't realized at the time. By we, I mean Gontrov, Ragu, Volovich, and I discovered in 2013, we accidentally discovered the first non-trivial generalization of this identity. So 2013, Gontrov et al. Discovered an identity of the following form. It's a 40-term identity. It's a 40-term Li 3 identity where the x's are drawn from cluster variables of what's called the D4 algebra. Again, you'll understand exactly what the D4 algebra is and what the A2 algebra is later on in my talk. to date, these are the only two identities of this form that are known. I mean, you can write trivial generalizations of these identities where you have some bigger cluster algebra and you take some A2 subalgebra or some D4 subalgebra, and for any such subalgebra, you can write such identities. But it's an interesting open mathematical problem, for example, to determine whether or not there exists any generalization of this kind of formula, say, to the function Lie 4, perhaps involving some bigger cluster algebra. Anyway, so these are two ways in which you can associate polylogarithm functions to cluster algebras. Now, they have the interesting, if useless, feature of both being the function 0. Okay, so here's an interesting way to associate the function 0 to the A2 cluster algebra. Here's an interesting way of associating the function 0 to the D4 cluster algebra. You can ask the question, are there interesting ways of associating non-zero functions to cluster algebras? And the answer is yes, and the answer is provided by maximally supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory. So SYM theory gives many non-trivial, so non-zero, cluster functions. And again, I put that phrase in quotes because I'm not yet defining what I mean by cluster function other than some kind of function that has some relation to some cluster algebra. Okay, so much for my teaser. Now I have to start defining and being a little bit more precise and rigorous about my whole presentation. But are there any questions so far? Have I at least piqued your interest? What is the meaning behind what? What is the meaning behind that identity? What context did he come across it on? I have no idea. Does anyone know? I think he was just exploring pure math. You know, the forefront of math in the 1800s was special functions, right? So, all right. And now we're back to special functions. They're just more special. All right, so let me say a brief word about scattering amplitudes. I appreciate that many or most of you are mathematicians, and I'll spare you all of the physics. Let me just, the main point I want to get across here is, if I'm to convince you that scattering amplitudes are a class of very rich and very interesting functions, the zeroth order question you want to know the answer to is, what are they functions of? Okay, so first of all, they're functions of three discrete labels, which you'll see throughout my talk and which I'll refer to. Sometimes I'll use little n to denote the number of particles. Okay, so we have some scattering process where some number of particles come in, some number of particles go out, and the total number of particles involved in the whole thing will be called n. Scattering amplitudes are complex valued functions whose modulus squared is proportional to the probability for some process to physically occur. And little n denotes the number of particles involved. Often, we compute scattering amplitudes in perturbation theory. Supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory has one parameter. It's an essentially unique theory with maximal n equals 4 supersymmetry in 4 dimensions, but it has one continuous parameter. And we often compute or organize our scattering amplitudes in perturbation theory in that parameter. So I'll sometimes use capital L to denote the loop order. And what that means is that, the word loop comes from the fact that you can calculate the L loop contribution by adding up Feynman diagrams that have a total of L internal loops. But I won't need any Feynman diagrams in my talk. I'm just introducing this parameter L, which tells you that everything we're computing is really in a Taylor series expansion organized by L. And then there's another discrete label, which is going to play very little role in my talk. It's traditionally called K in the physics literature, and it specifies the number, specifies the types of interacting particles. I'll be a little vague about this because it's not really too relevant for my purposes, but supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory is a theory of massless spin one particles, just like a photon. So just like a photon has two polarization states, it can be left-handed or right-handed circularly polarized. Each of the particles undergoing one of these scattering processes can be in one of two states. So K is a label which tells us how many of them are of one type and how many of them are of the other type. And I'll be a little bit, I'll just leave it at that because it's really plays no role. Okay, so a scattering amplitude then is a function of the n energy and momentum vectors. Okay. So each of the n particles will be associated with a four-component vector in Minkowski space-time. So this is just a four-dimensional space with a metric that's given by minus one, comma, plus one, plus one, plus one. The four components of this are the energy and the momentum of the particles. Satisfying pi squared equals zero for all I with respect to the metric, I just said this, these are all massless particles, so their energy and their momentum have to be related by this on-shell condition, and in addition, they must sum up to zero. Okay. There's a convention here. I should really mention it briefly. If you've got a number of particles coming in and a number of particles coming out, there's a symmetry in quantum field theory called crossing symmetry, which lets you essentially complex conjugate, but it lets you turn all of the outgoing particles into incoming particles. So it's always a convention in our field that when we talk about a scattering amplitude, we have in mind that all of the particles have inward or outward, all the same, whatever your choice is, momentum vectors. And when you adopt this convention, so normally you think of energy and momentum conservation saying that the total energy of the incoming particles should equal the total energy of the outgoing particles. But when you do this crossing operation and you change the sign of the energies of all the outgoing particles, then you can state the condition much more simply just as that. Okay, and of course, without loss of generality, I should just say it's always convenient to allow complexified momenta. That's because as soon as you start looking at scattering amplitudes as functions of complex variables, then of course you have a whole body of rich mathematics to apply to them. Even if at the end of the day, if you actually wanted to build an experiment and measure something, you would evaluate it on the real slice. Okay, so the question is the following: these two conditions here, these two conditions carve out an apparently non-trivial submanifold of C4n. non-trivial submanifold of C4n. And it's a little bit unpleasant to work with these variables because they're not free variables, they're restricted variables, and moreover, they satisfy a quadratic equation, which makes them a little bit unwieldy. So there's a remarkable invention called momentum twisters, which lets us find a very beautiful free parameterization of exactly the submanifold that we're interested in. And the way it works is as follows. So here's R1, 3. Here's momentum space. So we have these n vectors. Each is null. Each one is a null segment in Minkowski space. And they add up to zero because of this condition. So if I were to put them back to back, they would form a closed polygon. Then what I can do is define the location. I'm going to define variables, the xi, to be the locations in Minkowski space of these intersection points. Now, of course, there's a translation symmetry. I have to specify some choice of origin. Of course, that ends up being irrelevant because I could have chosen any origin. So suppose you specify some origin, and then you line up all your p's like that and let the xi's be the endpoints there. Then we use this beautiful fact that there's a correspondence between points xi in Minkowski space, in complexified Minkowski space. So let me be more clarified. Complexified. And lines in P3, complexified projective 3 space. So let me just remind you the way that works. Suppose you have some x in R1, 3, and you represent it as a 2x2 matrix. Okay, so what you do is, to this point in Minkowski space, you associate the point z let me explain my notation here. So z, I'm introducing capital Z here to denote a point in complex projective 3 space. And here I'm writing the homogeneous coordinates of that point, lambda 1, lambda 2, mu 1, mu 2. So for a given x, I'm defining this Z to be the set of all solutions of this linear equation. So in order to read this equation, think of lambda as a two-component column vector, mu as a two-component column vector, and x as a 2x2 matrix, as I've done there. Okay, obviously, lambda and mu are naturally projective coordinates, because if I multiply both sides, it's still a solution. So what we get here, then, is that for each of these x's, there's some line okay, and here's the real kicker, that the lines in P3 pairwise intersect. I'll prove that in a second. I.e., zi intersects zi plus 1 and zi minus 1 for each I. Of course, I'm understanding all my subscripts here to run modulo n. I'll come back to that point in just a second. Okay, this is really easy to see. It's really the most important aspect of this correspondence is the following. Suppose that, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's why I'm hesitating, because I'm about to prove something which completely contradicts what I've written there. Thanks. I'm sorry. Yeah. The lines. This is the line X1. I'm sorry. Thank you. This is the line X1. This is the line X2. This is the line XN, etc. And the Z's. Yeah. I'm sorry. Thank you. The Z's are the points of pairwise intersection. Okay. So. Let me explain that over here. The lines in P3 pairwise intersect. So suppose that some Z lies on the line corresponding to Xi and the line corresponding to Xi plus 1. So that means if we write Z as lambda mu, well, if it lies on the X1 line, that means that lambda is Xi mu. But if it also lies on this line, then it also satisfies that equation. Lambda is Xi mu, and lambda is Xi plus 1 times mu. And if you subtract one equation from the other, you find this. 0 is xi minus xi plus 1 times mu. And so here you've got a matrix equation. Remember, this is a 2x2 matrix, and that's a two-component column vector. So this equation can only be true in generic case for generic mu when this thing has a zero determinant. Requires xi minus xi plus 1 to have determinant 0. And if you go back, you can see from this parametrization that the determinant computes nothing other than the Minkowski norm. So that means that xi minus xi plus 1 is null. And since xi minus xi plus 1 is exactly what we called pi, that takes us back to our null condition for each of these legs, line segments. Okay. So let me leave that here and just summarize. I'll summarize and then come back to the picture to re-emphasize the summary. Oh, but if I can't erase anything. There's more blackboards? Oh, there's an eraser anyway. Okay. I have more blackboards. Good. I won't. Okay, so the summary is there's one more ingredient. I use this implicitly, and nobody asked about it, probably because the ones who would have asked know the answer, and I've probably been talking too fast for those of you who don't know this. But I implicitly gave a cyclic ordering to my points here. Whenever we talk about an amplitude, amplitude, and I should be honest here and say what we call planar super-Yang-Mills, which is a gauge theory and always has a gauge group associated to it, we mean the coefficient of some particular term proportional to a trace of gauge group generators in the Lie algebra of the gauge group. Okay, this will play absolutely no role in the rest of my talk, so I almost feel guilty for even bringing it up. But it does play a very important role here, a crucial role, because the full scattering amplitude is going to be a sum of things like this, each one times some function of the momenta. At any given moment in time, we're just going to look at the coefficient of one of these things. And the point is that the whatever the ordering of the particles is, of the particles associated to the generators of that particular term, that specifies a natural cyclic ordering to the particles. So notice here that the cyclic ordering played a huge role. I drew a closed polygon, and then these intersected one to the other in a cyclic way. So the statement is that the set of null momenta satisfying this total energy momentum conservation is in one-to-one correspondence with cyclically ordered points in P3. Now there's one more, I said one more ingredient, I really meant two. So we can assemble the endpoints Zi in P3 into a matrix, and it's an n by 4 matrix. So these are the n homogeneous coordinates of the points in P3, and there's a magical symmetry. Again, I won't explain where this comes from. You'll just have to take my word for it. There's a magical symmetry of S super Yang-Mills theory called dual conformal symmetry. Dual conformal symmetry. Which corresponds to left multiplication by SL4C, or you could call it GL4C. It doesn't matter because these are homogeneous coordinates anyway. Okay, so the point I'm trying to make is that the kinematic domain, so you'll just have to take this as a given without it. This is a magical feature which, at least in four dimensions, is unique to super Yang-Mills theory. There are other beautiful theories in other dimensions that can have this as well. But the point is that we finally, half an hour into the talk, we're finally at the point where I can answer the question, what is it that scattering amplitudes in super Yang-Mills theory are functions of? So in other words, what is the kinematic domain for SYM theory? And it is the set of ordered n-tuples of points in P3 modulo this symmetry group. Well, we can go ahead and give that a better name because, you know, suppose we go ahead and call this GL4C. It doesn't really matter because these are all homogeneous coordinates. If we call that GL4C, then modding out this set, the space of 4 by n matrices modulo the left action of GL4C, that gives us what's called the Grassmannian, GR4, n. But then it's not quite the Grassmannian that we have, because in addition, each of these columns in this presentation needs to be interpreted as a homogeneous coordinate in P3. So we need to further mod out by C star corresponding to the rescalings of each column. And here I put, I need to put not n, because if I went ahead and called this GL4C rather than SL4C, then the total overall rescaling I've already modded out by, so I should only put n minus 1 here. This is a space which we call conf n of P3. The true cognoscenti will not put an equal sign but a squiggle there, which means that they're birationally equivalent and you have to worry about certain details. There are extremely important details lurking at the boundaries of this space that play a very crucial role also in scattering amplitudes, but I'll not have anything to say about it in my talk. So we call this space conf, it's red confn of P3, that means configurations of endpoints in P3, and it's just this, it's the set of ordered n tuples of points in P3 modulo this left action. Okay. So scattering amplitudes in Super-Yang-Mills theory are functions on this manifold. Any questions at this point?
Like you said, set of conformal structures on P3 or something like this?
Oh, no, conf stands for configurations. So configurations of endpoints in P3 modulo this SL4C, and this SL4C in physics comes from what we call dual conformal symmetry.
Can you say something like how this C star to the n minus 1 really, like what's the geometric picture of this action of C star?
It's just rescaling each column because these columns are supposed to be homogeneous coordinates.
What was the argument for multiplying by C star to the n minus 1?
Well, it had to do with whether you call this GL or SL. So in order to call this the Grassmannian, you would want to call that GL. But if you call that GL, then the overall rescaling, you've already modded. So the Grassmannian is the quotient of such matrices modulo GL. But you don't want to double count that overall scaling. So this is a manifold, you know, if you're ever worried about plus or minus one, it's a manifold of dimension 3 times n minus 5. 3n, because you've got n coordinates in P3, minus 15, because that's the dimension of SL4C.
Here are four.
Yeah, the Grassmannian of four planes in n space. It depends on whether you read this, right? You can read this as this or the transpose. Yeah.
But you sort of wrote the components vertically.
Yes, so yes, I snuck that in. Yeah.
The vertical scaling is compatible with the horizontal scaling, so I'm a little, that's why I'm a little thrown off.
Right, it's consistent with, this is a perfectly fine quotient space, but it's different. Right.
I see that once you make that quotient space, then that takes care of that scale.
Yeah.
I see. Okay. Now I'm happy.
Any other questions?
So if n is less than 5, what happens?
So what it tells you, I mean, this was discovered through enormous effort in the physics community, but what it tells you is that particles with scattering amplitudes with 5 or fewer particles are trivial, essentially. Again, not to disparage anyone in the audience, including me, who've written lengthy papers computing such amplitudes, but in the modern, you know, from the modern perspective, they're all trivial. All right. Okay. So now let's discuss some coordinates on this space. So by way of notation, I'll use the bracket here to denote the usual Plucker coordinates. So if you pick any four of these, then you can make a quantity which is SL4C invariant by taking the determinant. However, this thing is not yet a good coordinate on our manifold because it's not compatible with the scaling symmetry, right? It's fine. You just have to understand that this also has a scaling weight. If you know these are each homogeneous coordinates, so if you rescale any one of these, this thing will scale by an overall factor. In order to make honest to goodness coordinates on our manifold, we should construct cross ratios. And there are many ways to do it. I'll pick a few which will be convenient for later on in my talk. I mean, they'll appear later in a different role. Okay, this is now a perfectly fine example of a coordinate on our kinematic manifold. It's constructed out of Plucker coordinates, so it's SL4C invariant, and also each particle appears the same number of times upstairs as downstairs. So this thing is honestly invariant under the projective rescaling. Let me define a couple more. 1, 4, 5, 6, 2, 3, 4, 6, 1, 2, 4, 6, 3, 4, 5, 6. And you'll notice that in these examples, only involve 6 particles. My labels never exceed the number 6. So these are 3 perfectly fine coordinates. Xi are coordinates on the 3-dimensional manifold conf. You can choose them as coordinates on the 3-dimensional manifold conf 6P3. Okay. Now I will use the eraser. Okay. Now I have enough material to show you an example of something which was the impetus for this whole body of work. So here's a phenomenological aside. I promise you that if you go start computing these amplitudes, laborious as it may be, you'll never... let me claim... And I guess, strictly speaking, this is a conjecture because not all amplitudes have been computed by far. I'll put here conjecture. You may see something like, let me just pull an example. When you look up these computations in the literature, they typically go on for dozens, if not hundreds of pages. So your eyes start to glaze over. So here's an example of something which might result from a laborious calculation. It's a perfectly fine function on, in this case, conf 8 of P3, because this is something which might appear for an 8-particle scattering amplitude. But the claim is you'll never see this thing with, for example, that 7 and that 8 exchanged. You'll never see it. So this research, one of the motivations for this research was to understand if there's a reason behind this kind of phenomenon. And this kind of research can have two benefits, a practical benefit and a theoretical benefit. The theoretical benefit is it can open your eyes to some kind of deeper mathematical structure of your theory, which was lurking there always, and you never really realized it. But also can have practical benefits, because often when you're undertaking a difficult calculation, if you have some hint of what the answer might look like, or what kind of structure the answer should have, or what kind of structure the answer can't have, that can guide you a long way towards the answer, right? If you're taking a final exam in a math course, show that questions are sometimes easier than, you know, more generally phrased questions. So the point is, if we can understand a reason why something like this with the blue quantities exchange could never ever appear in Super-Yang-Mills theory, then we might hope that one day we could develop a formulation of the theory, or at least a calculational tool, where that would be manifest from the beginning. So we would never have to worry about extra stuff appearing and then magically canceling at the end when you add up 10,000 Feynman diagrams. It would just be, the garbage would be absent from the beginning. Okay, so that's sort of a motivational aside, and it will not surprise you, given the talk of my lectures, that the answer has to do with cluster algebras. So this quantity here, I'm now going to move on to cluster algebras, and we'll see that this quantity here is a cluster coordinate on conf 8 of P3, but the thing with 7 and 8 exchanged is not. Okay. Right. Yeah, I had in mind, you might be computing some two-loop scattering amplitude, and you, the Li 4, I haven't introduced that yet, I'm sorry, it's a generalization of the Pauli logarithm function. Oh, yeah, I already referred to Li 3 and Li 4 without defining them. Hold on, let me correct that error and then readdress your question. This is important. So I was just saying you might compute some scattering amplitude and find that it contains a term like that, but I promise you you'll never find the analogous thing with 7 and 8 exchanged. Okay, so I basically set the stage, and I now have to introduce some more technology. I'm going to introduce cluster algebras. That'll probably take me the rest of this lecture. And then at the beginning of the next lecture, I'll introduce some of the mathematical tools we have at our disposal when discussing Pauli logarithm functions. Okay, cluster algebras. Now this is an enormous topic in mathematics, and I'm going to be restricting my attention only to a very small subset, of course, the subset which happens to play a role in Super Yang-Mills theory, and that has to do, in particular, with cluster, what we call cluster Poisson varieties. And these were discovered and studied and introduced by Falk and Goncharov. These play a role whenever you're interested in functions on a manifold, and that manifold has a natural Poisson structure. So that is indeed, I didn't need to mention it, but this manifold inherits from the Grassmannian a natural Poisson structure, rendering this an example of a cluster Poisson variety. But I'll start with a little bit of a more general introduction. So the idea behind cluster algebras is these are algebras generated by a preferred set of what are called cluster coordinates. Grouped into clusters. Okay, so clusters, at least for this particular type of cluster algebra, clusters can be represented by quivers. So let's say we have, I'll pick an example of a cluster algebra where we start with three variables, x1, x2, and x3. So this will just be an example. The fact that I'm using the same variables, x1 and x2 and x3, as I did over there, is not coincidental, but I'll make the connection precise in a few moments. For the moment, just imagine that you're starting abstractly with a quiver, a labeled quiver. So each node is labeled by some variable. And the idea is there exists something which we call the mutation rule to generate new clusters or quivers. And I'll explain the mutation rule, and we'll do a few examples. So the mutation rule on the quiver is first pick some node j to mutate on. Okay, so in general, if you have a quiver with k different nodes, there are k different ways to mutate it. You pick one node, and then you do an operation called mutation on that node. Okay, second, for each path I, J, K, add an arrow connecting I directly with K. Third, reverse all arrows into or out of J. And fourth, delete all two cycles. Okay, these are the mutation rules at the level of quivers. Let's do an example. Example, let's mutate that quiver I just drew. X1, X2, X3, on X2. So the first thing we I picked a node to mutate on. Now we observe that there's one path that goes through that node. So we add an arrow. We add an arrow that directly connects X1 to X3, and then we reverse these two arrows, and now we're done because there are no two cycles, so there was nothing to do. Oh, except I need to apologize. This is topologically correct, but the variables are going to change according to a rule that I need to write down in a moment. So. I'll do that in just a second. I'm just explaining the topology now. Let's mutate again, just so we are sure that we're comfortable with these rules. Now I misplaced my eraser. So let's mutate on the leftmost node. Okay. So starting from this one, if we mutate on the leftmost node, well, we observe there is a path through the leftmost node like that, so I need to add there's a path from this one to that one, so I need to add that directly. Now I reverse the direction of all the arrows going into or out of the node I'm mutating on, and then I delete all two cycles. That means a cycle with only two edges. So this is the result. It's, of course, topologically equivalent to the one, it's not even topologically equivalent. What am I saying? Never mind. Yeah, it is topologically equivalent to the one I originally started with, just the variables have been permuted a little bit. Okay, but there's an important ingredient I haven't explained yet. First of all, I haven't explained what I'm doing. It just looks like playing games. But I need to explain how the quiver labels transform under mutation. So let Bij be the number of arrows counted with sign. I'll explain what that is in case it's not clear, from I to J. So example, in this quiver that we started with, this corresponds to the B matrix So there's a 1 in this entry because there's one arrow from this node to that node. This entry is 1 because there's one arrow from that node to that node. And you get a minus sign if you get an outgoing arrow. So this entry is minus 1 because there's one arrow incoming, if you will. So this is always going to be an anti-symmetric matrix with integer entries. So now with that terminology, I'm ready to write down the mutation rule. So it's obvious, I mean, the quivers are cute. It's obvious I could have just as well not mentioned the quivers and just written down, just said that the structure of a cluster Poisson variety is specified by an integer-valued anti-symmetric matrix. You can draw the quiver if I give you such a matrix. If we mutate the collection x1, x2, however many there are on your quiver, on xj, then the variables transform into, the rule is that the variable associated to the node that you're mutating is inverted. But the other ones transform in a little bit more complicated way. Okay. I apologize, I didn't prepare this. Had I been more conscientious, I would have written all of the labels. So you can use this rule to follow how the variables transform from an initial quiver through each step of the mutation. And if you prefer, and B prime equals the, I'm not going to write a formula for it. There is a formula for it. It's the formula that corresponds to implementing those rules. So B prime is the B matrix associated to the new mutated quiver. So I hope that's clear. I'll summarize. Each quiver here, it's a labeled quiver, so every node carries some variable. But the variables, once you start mutating, they're related to each other. So these variables here, they will all be rational functions of x1, x2, and x3, given by this formula. So you can keep going, mutating and mutating and mutating, and you generate in this manner collections of rational functions of the original variables that you started with. And then in each quiver or in each cluster, there's an associated B matrix that's just the signed number of arrows. So now here's the point, finally. Yeah.
They consider this graphs, seeds, and clusters.
Yeah.
So, but you're considering only two objects right now, so you're disregarding something. Seeds, maybe?
I don't think so.
So the word seed refers to, you have to remember in my example that I started with A2, I said that because the recursion involves the two previous variables, you have to take X1 and X2 as your seed. So the word seed refers to the original variables that you start with. So in this example, this would be my seed. I can seed this mutation operation with X1 and X2 and X3, and then I can generate all possible cluster variables as rational functions of them.
There's that. Context, present variables tend to appear in
any way? I'm hiding all of that under the rug. Yeah, because in the, for the Gontrov coordinates, there's another way of, there's an alternative way of presenting this information that fortunately I can sidestep. But I'd be happy to explain that more later. These, what I'm describing here are what Falk and Gontrov call the X coordinates. And there's a way to relate them to the so-called cluster A coordinates at the expense of introducing a few auxiliary variables, the frozen variables. Okay, so the point is the following, that on a cluster Poisson variety, these brackets refer to the Poisson bracket. So a cluster Poisson variety, okay, I should phrase this grammatically correct. I'm not emphasizing the implication of this. You start, or you choose a collection of, let's call them log canonical coordinates on your variety, on your cluster plus on variety. Okay, so I should have written that sentence first. The point is, you start with some space called a cluster Poisson variety. It has a Poisson structure, and what you do, if you can, is choose a set of functions on that space that are log canonical with respect to the Poisson bracket. That means the log of xi, Poisson bracket with the log of xj, is equal to this anti-symmetric integer-valued matrix. Okay, so this is the mysterious Bij, which specifies the topology of the quiver. And then the point is, this mutation rule is very cleverly designed. You can check that log, this is no surprise, log of xi prime, log of xj prime is bij prime under any mutation. So the point of this mutation operation is that it's a way to generate Poisson preserving. I mean, preserving is not quite the right word because B changes, but coordinate transformations that are compatible in this way with the Poisson structure. And in fact, it's not quite a theorem, but it should be a theorem in the sense that everyone believes it to be a theorem, that mutations generate all possible such coordinate transformations.
So 2D
computations were done at INJ or?
No. I took a collection of variables, the x's. I pick one, I mutate on of it, and all of the variables transform, right? According to that rule.
Okay,
they all transform to the xi primes. The xi primes are the variables that label my new quiver. And that new quiver has maybe a different topology, so it has a different B prime matrix. But you could, I mean, it's just a simple algebra to check that this is true. That this plus the mutation rule plus the transformation on the B, which I didn't write, gives you that. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so a while ago I introduced three variables, x1, x2, and x3, on conf6 of P3, and I didn't state it at the time, but this is their actual Poisson bracket. The expressions were there on the board several minutes ago. If you would use the natural Poisson bracket induced from the natural Poisson structure in the Grassmannian and compute, you know, log of x1 Poisson bracket with log of x2, you would find it's 1. Log of x1 with log of x3 would be 0, etc. Okay, so that ends the discussion of the sort of the construction of the kinds of cluster algebras which are relevant to us. I want to tell you several facts about them.
Does it satisfy the property of the Poisson bracket? Like, I guess that bracket as defined, would it satisfy all the axioms of a bracket?
You mean like, yeah. Well, if you begin with a collection of variables, it will be preserved. Anything you need will. It's important that it's not necessarily symplectic. I mean, this is an odd dimensional manifold. It certainly can't be symplectic. but it's, anyway. Okay. There's a complete classification of finite cluster algebras of Grassmannian type. So this phrase of Grassmannian type means precisely conf n on pk. So for scattering amplitudes in 4 space-time dimensions, we're interested in k equals 3, but there's no harm in considering more general k. And mathematicians have completely classified finite cluster algebra. So let me explain. Finite means that the number of distinct quivers is finite. See, I didn't pursue this case to exhaustion, but each time you get a new quiver, you have 3 choices of what to mutate on. Like, you could mutate on here, here, or here. Sometimes you'll go back to a quiver that you've already seen before. Sometimes you'll go to yet a new quiver. Okay. So a cluster algebra is said to be finite. Let me finish this. The number of quivers is finite, and the number of distinct coordinates is finite. On the other hand, a cluster algebra is said to be a finite mutation type if the number of distinct quivers is finite, but but the number of coordinates is infinite. Of distinct. So remember that coordinates are always going to be rational functions of whatever variables you started with in your seed. So you can continue this mutation operation, and in a finite cluster algebra, after you exhaust all possible mutations of every possible quiver, you'll get a closed set. And moreover, the variables living on the nodes will be a finite collection. In an algebra that's a finite mutation type, what that means is that you'll only ever encounter a finite collection of topologically distinct quivers, but you may encounter the same quiver, exactly the same topology again, but labeled with different variables than it had the previous time. So in an algebra of this type, you can keep going around and around, you know, mutate 27 times, come back to some quiver you had before, but with the variables different. And you'll get an infinite number of variables. So mathematicians have completely classified these, at least for the Grassmannian cluster algebras. And since the classification actually does play some role for physics, I'll review what it is. The statement is that an algebra is finite. An algebra is finite if and only if it can be it has quivers which can be brought, which by a mutation can be brought to the form form of a Dynkin diagram of one of the classical finite groups, you know. Okay. So earlier, okay, so example conf 6 of P3, which I've already told you, you can generate in this manner. That's manifestly the Dynkin diagram of the A3 algebra. So this is called the A3 cluster algebra. This one has 14 distinct quivers. And 30 distinct cluster coordinates. Okay.
Question?
Yeah.
So you start with this Dynkin diagram, but then you apply mutation, you get a fine type, right?
Right. So this, it's not required that every quiver you get should be of a finite Lie algebra type, only that there exists amongst all the possible quivers that are related to by mutation, if there exists one that is of the classical type, then the algebra is guaranteed to be finite.
And we can get even
wild type? Yeah, right. So let me do some more examples. Let me do some more examples, and then I think I'm not quite understanding your question, but that probably is because I've explained it poorly. Yeah, sorry, simply late.
Homogeneous ring of conflict
6P3 or what? What is the class that you write in the homogeneous ring of your
yeah, I think what you're asking what is the algebra? It's the algebra of essentially products and rational functions of these coordinates. But everyone always asks that because we almost never actually use. It's called a cluster algebra, but we almost never use the algebra feature of it.
Generated
by cluster coordinates.
Starting from a single quiver?
Sure. It's the algebra generated by the union of all cluster coordinates that you can generate via all possible mutations. From a quiver, yeah,
okay.
That's sufficient.
I see. So I guess in your definition of finite, then you can just pick any quiver. It doesn't, I mean, because it's all generated under.
Yeah, that's right, a quiver. Okay, I understand.
The plane that we also have generated by all of those clusters is the coordinate. The function on that, right?
Well, no, not any function. No, because these are all. You wouldn't get all functions.
It's like a subalgebra.
It's a function. Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's right.
Mutation invertible.
Yes. Yes. It's not maybe not obvious from that formula, but it is invertible. You just go back up where you came from. If you mutate on the middle node, and then you mutate on the middle node again, you come back to where you started. Thanks. That's an important property. All right. So the algebra associated with confn of pk can be generated from the seed quiver, which looks like this. You put k columns here. And n minus k minus 2 rows. So this is the statement. It's certainly not, I mean, I don't mean to pretend that it's obvious, but it's true that you can select a collection of coordinates on this Grassmannian quotient whose Poisson bracket with respect to the natural Poisson structure has the form of this matrix. And then you can define a cluster algebra by considering all possible mutations of this quiver. So the A3 example we've already encountered here. Let me state next. An example which is relevant to scattering amplitudes in super Yang-Mills theory is conf 7 of P3, which is relevant to 7 particle amplitudes. Here you start with a quiver that's 3 by 2. And I don't pretend that it's obvious, but by a sequence of mutations, you can reach the E6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, yeah. Oops, I almost drew E4, D4. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, E6. E6 Dinkin diagram. So this algebra is called the E6 algebra. It has 833 quivers or clusters, and it has a total of 770 variables. These are not, you can have an undergraduate student take Mathematica and plug in these rules and have them generate, start with the initial quiver, mutate on all possible nodes, you make a big list, now mutate on every possible node of every one of those, repeat until you've exhausted the entire space, and then you find those numbers. Good. Thank you for asking. No, you can. You're asking what would happen here if I just started by having those reversed, and in that, you don't get anything genuinely new because you can undo that by an appropriate inversion or relabeling of the variables. Like you know that if you change, you can change the sign of. You can change the sign of any row or column of the Poisson bracket matrix by inverting, right? If you take x goes to 1 minus, x goes to 1 over x, then log x goes to log minus log x. So there's a way to, I'm not saying it's necessarily obvious, but there's a way to undo any possible. That's why here, it doesn't matter how you draw the arrows. A more interesting example, relevant to 8-particle amplitudes, is conf8 of P3, which is a finite mutation type. It doesn't change the cluster algebra. It might. That's right. You might have to do a relabeling of x1, x2, and x3 into. Let's call it y1, y2, and y3, but there will be some simple relation between the x's and the y's. So it doesn't give you anything genuinely new. So here there are 506 distinct quivers. Interesting that it's smaller than that number, but infinitely many variables. Okay. Let's see. Oh yeah, the last thing I wanted to say, this is important, is that it's useful to visualize the combinatorics of mutation as a polytope. So let's say we start here let this be the seed quiver for A3. So to say again what I mean by that, I mean this quiver. Or if you prefer to think about it a different way, I mean these three variables with this Poisson structure. Okay. So you just, let me not make it a square, let me just make it a point. So I'm going to draw a polytope now. I'm going to draw a polytope where each vertex of my polytope is a cluster. And I'm going to connect two vertices if they're related by mutation. So starting from this quiver, there are three different ways you can mutate, x1, x2, or x3. So let's imagine, okay, you can go off in three directions by mutating on any of the three variables. Now, on this node, there are only two other ways to go, because As was raised by the question there, if you mutate again on the same node that you mutated on to get over here, you'll just go back. So there are two other ways to mutate like that. And so we can continue filling out this polytope by imagining all possible ways of doing mutations. And what we get is this wonderful object called K5. Oops, and I didn't make it K5. Sorry. And then there's one. Okay, I wish I had drawn it a little more symmetrically. Okay. Anyway, it's a polytope with 9 faces and 14 vertices. I'm sorry? Oh, yeah, you're right. I've only given it the structure of a graph. Right. Oh, good. Yes, I've drawn it here implicit. Okay. Excellent question. The faces correspond to subalgebras of co-rank 1. So, and I need to describe in detail the subalgebras because it will play an important role in what follows. So that's an excellent opportunity to end this lecture.